Going here. Here Hello. So I'd like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for Adeo Charter School Nonprofit Board, which operates Adeo 2 Charter School, Adeo Charter School 3, Adeo Valley Charter School, Grossmont Secondary School, Mira Secondary School, and Sweetwater Secondary School. I am Greg Haggard, Chairman of the Board. I will facilitate the meeting. Let's take the roll first. When I call your name, please provide the group with a brief introduction for the benefit of new members and members of the public. So Laura Barrero.
Laura Barrero, board member.
Thank you. Waylon Myers.
Waylon Myers, board member.
Christina Stevens.
Christina Stevens, board member.
Thank you. And do we have, we don't have Jim Hare as a guest here today or Chris, but yeah, I've introduced myself, so thank you. The first item on the agenda is 1.3, consideration and approval of adoption of the board findings pursuant to Government Code Section 54953E1. So the Adeo Charter School Board of Directors determines, in accordance with Government Code Section 54953E1B, that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health or safety of attendees. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54953E3, the board has also reconsidered the circumstances of the state of emergency declared by the governor on March 4th, 2020, and finds the state of emergency continues to directly impact the ability of directors to meet safely in person and or that state or local officials continue to impose or recommend measures to promote social distancing. Additionally, AB 361 requires that this finding be made every 30 days to continue to permit teleconference meetings without adhering to some of the traditional requirements of the Brown Act, specifically with the teleconference requirements of Government Code Section 54953B3. Do I have a motion for approval of item 1.3?
Laura Barrera, I make a motion that we approve item 1.3.
Waylon Myers, I second that motion.
Thank you. And one of these provisions, I need to call for your vote to be clear on this. So I will do so. Laura Barrera, your vote, please.
Laura Barrera, aye.
Thank you. Waylon Myers?
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina?
Stevens? Christina Stevens, aye.
Thank you. And Greg Haggard is aye. So that passed unanimously. So 1.4, establishment of quorum. Do I have a motion for approval of item 1.4?
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we approve item 1.4.
Christina?
Christina Stevens, aye.
Thank you. I will call for your vote. Laura Barrero?
Laura Barrero, aye.
Waylon Myers?
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina Stevens?
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Greg Haggard is aye, so that passes unanimously. Thank you. So 1.5, the Pledge of Allegiance. Angela, you're up with our flag. Or maybe you can't do it. We're going to go ahead. Presume everyone has a flag. Ready? Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you, Tim.
Well done, Tim.
So we're at 1.6, the approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion for approval with the recommendation from Mary Bixby?
So recommended.
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we approve item 1.6.
Waylon Myers, I second that motion.
Thank you. And Laura, your vote, please.
Laura Barrero, aye.
And Waylon?
Waylon Myers, aye.
Christina Stevens?
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Greg Haggard is aye. That passes unanimously. So 2.0, public comment. Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of the Adeo Charter School Nonprofit Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur regarding items that are not on the agenda at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to briefly respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may equivalently decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. So 2.1, non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? I see no members of the public, and hearing nothing, I'll move along to 2.2, agenda items public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on agenda items? Likewise, hearing none, going to move on to 3.0, board workshop training. So 3.1, Young Minion Core Law Firm will provide training to the board regarding professional development training, including best practices in charter schools board management, updates on the Charter Schools Act, and a review of corporate practices, fiduciary duties, and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act, and conflict of interest laws. So thank you, board members, for confirming your attendance and participation for part one of the board workshop and training. Part two will be October 17th. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. That'll be the second session. So with that, Mary, did you want to introduce, or Tim, Young Minion Core, and kick us off with the training?
Everybody knows Young Minion Core, I'm sure. We've worked with them. I'm not sure everyone knows our staff here. We have Haley Dupre. Haley is the lead administrator for Carlsbad, the two Carlsbads. Help me with this, Haley. And
Adeo 2 and Adeo.
Adeo 2 and Adeo. And Sharnita Moore has our wonderful new charter at Moreno Valley. She's got a beautiful site going on over there. She's the head of the schools. And who do I see? Allison. Allison is new on board. She's a lead, and she took over Haley's assignment. So she's got Grossmont and Sweetwater, correct? And I see Alex. Alex has been up as a lead for quite a while up at Maris. Does a wonderful, wonderful job. And of course, you know, Lynn and Tim. Did I miss anybody? Angela, of course, who's always there for us. I think that's it in terms of staff.
Thank you. Well, there's a couple of you that I have not met yet. So thank you so much for participating in the meetings. It's nice to see some new faces. I just appreciate your support. You want me to jump in, Mary?
No, you go ahead.
Yes. All right. Let me do a screen share here. Let me get this rolling.
There will be no test after this, right?
That is correct. And if everybody let me know that you're seeing the slides.
I see the slides.
All right, great. I have two monitors, and it always kind of gets hard to determine what's going on here. So anyway, thank you guys for having us. Today, we promise, at least you don't have to listen to me talk for 2 hours. My colleague, Kayla Haydu, our senior counsel of the firm, is also here. And so we're going to share some of these slides as we go through this. Like you said, we're going to talk about best practices in charter school management, ciphered through almost 30 years of working with charter schools throughout the state of California now and some other various states. We're going to talk about updates in the charter school law, but today we're also going to focus on the Brown Act, conflicts, fiduciary duties, and a general overview of the operational aspects and unique nature of charter schools and nonprofit boards for which you sit on. I know some of you, or maybe all of you, actually probably sit on multiple nonprofit public benefit corporation boards. And we're going to focus on the distinct differences between sitting on this board over these schools versus the other work that you might be doing. But again, thank you. And I understand we're going to break this into two parts, and we will try to be as efficient as we can with our time. And I know we go from one to three today. Just a little bit about our firm. Yeah, as Mary said, I started in 1993 when the Charter Schools Act started. And we have a number of partners, including Jim Young and myself and Lisa Kaur and Jerry Simmons, that have been around almost since the beginning. So we've got about 150 years of collective experience among the partners working with schools. We do work mostly with charter schools in California, although we do have clients in Arizona, Nevada, Washington, and we've done some work in Tennessee recently. Clients are starting to branch out into Texas, Georgia, and we've done some work in New York in the past as well. We kind of do everything for the schools. So we do employment laws, special education facilities, charter renewal development,
nonprofit, and we do, unfortunately, a large amount of litigation on behalf of defending the schools, but more frequently, I should say, Kayla and I do a lot of litigation where we're actually suing somebody on behalf of the school, and it typically as a school district or county office of education. We work with probably a little more north of 600 charter schools in the state of California. There's 1,100 to 1,200 operative charter schools in the state of California. And we do a lot of workshops like this for our clients, including throughout the state of California for the last 30 years. So appreciate you guys having us here. All right, so I know this is gonna sound a little, taking a step back, but I wanna give context for what we're talking about here. So what it means to be a charter. And as most of you know, Charter Schools Act passed in 1992. So as by way of legal entities in the state of California, charter schools are still in their infancy. They're relatively young, almost 30-year-old beast here in the state of California. And as you might know a little bit of the history here, the state was considering a voucher initiative. And in an odd alliance between some of the Democrats and Republicans back then, they decided that charters would be a better alternative than giving money to parents who could attend private schools, use those monies to attend private schools. And so there was the passage of the Charter Schools Act in 1992. And the basic bargain for that since that time has always been a relief from the overly prescriptive and proscriptive education code. If I had a copy of it here, I'd be able to hold it up. And it's about 12 inches of 9-point type double space. It's just thousands and thousands of code sections that overly bind the regular K-12 public education system. And the idea was, look, we will, charter schools, release you from that education code in exchange for academic accountability. And that is the basic bargain. And you'll hear, as we talk about board oversight responsibilities and functions, one of the main functions is to maintain course towards the academic accountability that you promised, the schools promised when the schools started. Charters are unlike normal nonprofits that have perpetual existence until they unilaterally decide to close themselves. Charters have life cycles. They get approved, they get renewed, some cases merged, as you know, with Mirus, and they can be revoked or non-renewed. And so right now, unfortunately, we're still looking at mostly 5-year cycles of all charters in the state of California. We've had, I would think, about 30% attrition over the years. About 30% of all newly approved charter schools fail or close. But that was part of the experiment. There was a very entrepreneurial aspect brought to the Charter Schools Act when it was passed in 1992. The idea was we would bring parents, community members, entrepreneurs, business people together to start schools and that they would try new things with the goal to improve academic performance, try out new teaching methods, try out new educational methods. And we would give them the flexibility to be able to do that. And as a result, some schools have failed. But the idea was we knew that some schools would fail and we would learn from that. So the main things about charters you got to know is it is initially all about academic accountability. And I say initially because unfortunately in 30 years and through some failures and some problems with charter schools, the legislature year over year just keeps legislating, and they just keep pushing more and more of the traditional K-12 bureaucracy and education code onto charter schools every year. So the second thing that charter schools have become about, which is not great and was never initially intended, is about legal compliance. So academic accountability first, legal compliance, boy, they're almost neck and neck these days. And then, you know, the board is overseeing a multi-million dollar organization that is operating with public funds. So the main third bucket is about fiscal solvency. So the board's main functions to monitor and oversee academic accountability, legal compliance, fiscal solvency. Now, interestingly, the Charter Schools Act allowed charter schools to be operated as nonprofit public benefit corporations. And you would think that after 30 years, I could tell you unequivocally whether a charter school is private or public, whether it is private, like a normal nonprofit public benefit corporation is, or whether it's purely public, like a regular K-12 school district. But unfortunately, all I can say is it depends. In a lot of cases, you've got your feet in both worlds. And in most cases, the most burdensome laws from the private sector apply in both cases, because you have your feet in both worlds, unfortunately. So you have to keep that in mind, that you are a mostly, I would say, if someone asked me in an elevator, I'd say, well, you're mostly a public school operating as a nonprofit public private corporation, and you have aspects of a private corporation. But because you're publicly funded, providing a public good with public oversight, in most cases, you'd be deemed a public school and a public agency. Now, you've got it because you're a nonprofit. And again, those of you who are on nonprofit boards, you have articles of incorporation. I'll talk about the specific common purpose here that is very common between ADEO and SSP Corporation. The articles, incorporations, and bylaws are alongside your charter, another body of documents everybody should have a copy of or access to readily, because they do prescribe and prescribe your actions. They outline dedication of assets for the charitable purpose of the organization. The corporate bylaws outline everything from the election of board members to the removal of board members to terms, to indemnity of board members, et cetera, as you would normally see. And key to the bylaws, there is a board member election and a process outlined in there.
May I ask you something?
Sure, please, anytime.
Although we're two separate corporations, we are perceived as one organization, which legally we're not one organization. However, we refer to ourselves as Altus Schools because we are a replication of the original Anchor School. As far as nonprofits go, we are collectively a $60 million operation, which would put us, I believe, among the medium-sized corporations in the state. Is that correct?
That sounds correct. I've never compared the nonprofits. I know that by way of number of kids and dollar volume of your budget, you're well into the above top half of even K-12 sized school districts. Majority of school districts in state of California have 1,500 kids. It's only, yes. We hear about the San Diegos, the Oaklands, the Sacramento, San Franciscos, but you're in that next cut down of size.
Next cut up.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got those are the big boys, the San Diego, LA, Sacramento, et cetera. And then the next layer down is organizations your size.
Right. I was told too that as nonprofits go, we are considered a very large nonprofit corporation.
I would not doubt that to be case. I can only think of, some of the larger ones like the Red Cross, but even those have chapters and separate budgets. So, yes.
Well, so do we.
Right.
And yes, that would be an example of a very large nonprofit. Right. But I think it's important for us to kind of absorb the concept of largeness, because we operate in a very friendly kind of small town way, although always in compliance. But I think that it's important for us to realize that we are operating as a medium to large, in some cases, nonprofit corporation. So we're really obligated to stay on top of everything.
I like what you're saying there, Mary, about the formality versus informality of your operation, because you are dealing with public money, and you'll see later when I talk about the conflicts of interest laws and fiduciary duties, the layer and the obligations of your board and the administrators to maintain that level of formality and legal compliance is very high. And the downside risk is very high as well. So absolutely, that's a good point. And there is a slide later on, Mary, where I emphasize and talk a little more about the Altus Schools umbrella and the two corporations and how they stand side by side and operate in a collaborative fashion too.
Thank you.
Your board is self-perpetuating. That's an option you all have selected. That's the most common, and by the way, the most successful, I would say, board selection process in the state of California. Schools that have tried delegating the authority to appoint your board to, say, all parents or community members or whatnot, those schools have historically had very high turnover of their board, their administrators, and the school struggle. So self-perpetuating board is great. Every nonprofit has, and in this case, has a restriction on what's called interested board members. interested board members or anyone who has either directly does or who has received or is married to someone who in the direct dependent family has received compensation from the organization in the past 12 months. So there is no more than 49% of your board can be interested board members. And so that's something we need to monitor as well. Director's terms per your bylaws are 6 years, which is the minimum or the maximum term actually allowed in the corporation's code, but you can be renewed after that. And the bylaws allow for removal of board members by a majority of the board with or without cause. And the education code or the Charter Schools Act allows for a granting agency representative to be placed on your board. Now, the idea there was that they could, you know, monitor the operations of the charter school. But one of the primary benefits in the Charter Schools Act of a charter being operated as a nonprofit was that the granting agency would be immune from the debts and liabilities of the charter school. And as of today's date, only in one case in 30 years has a granting agency been found anywhere fiscally responsible for the debts and obligations of the charter school. So that insulation is key. So most granting agencies do not place somebody on a charter school board because they don't want that connection between the way the school operates and their immunity in the Charter Schools Act.
And that has evolved, if I might add, over the last 30 years, because at the beginning, they were very strict about, oh, we need to have somebody that's representing the superintendent on the board, which we did. And they were not comfortable with 501c3s, which we had to really work at achieving. We did it through a grant from, I can't remember now.
The Business Roundtable, maybe?
No, I can't remember right now. Gerard gave us a grant and we worked on how charter schools could become 501c3s, nonprofit corporations. Then they went full circle and arrived at where Paul is, what he's speaking of. And that is, oh no, by the way, that is a good idea because we want absolutely no responsibility. So we want distance. So over 30 years, there's been a huge cycle in terms of how they viewed charter schools acting as an independent corporation. Right now, they're into independent corporation. You know, you live or die on your own sword.
And I'd say about 98% of the charter schools in the state of California, 96-98%, are operated as nonprofit public benefit corporations.
And that was a big deal. There were six of us schools that worked under that corporation. And again, we were one of the first that managed that whole idea. And then pretty soon everyone in California did it.
No, it was a good amendment to the Charter Schools Act.
It was a great amendment.
Yeah. So the bylaws also outline the voting of the board. As you know, your quorum of your board makes up you can have a meeting when you have a quorum, and a majority of quorum makes a decision. You are non-compensated board members. Thank you for your service because there's a huge benefit to that because the highest level of immunity in the corporation's code and in the law comes from volunteer board members. The law encourages people to volunteer for nonprofit public benefit corporation board membership, and in doing so, they insulate board members. And again, I can say over 30 years, I've never seen a nonprofit public benefit corporation board member liable for the debts and obligations of the organization. With one exception, and that person stole money from the school, and so they were found liable in that case. But again, assuming nobody is taking advantage of that and stealing money, the insulation is very good. Corporation's code requires you to have three officers, a president, treasurer, and a secretary. Your bylaws outline those responsible for those actions. And in this case, your president is you're equal to in the bylaws, your chief executive officer, the day-to-day manager of your organization, and your primary point of contact as a board, which I'll talk about in a minute. And again, the bylaws also outline the indemnity. So four key similarities here between any other nonprofit board you sit on and this organization would be your fiduciary duties, which we'll outline, duty of loyalty, duty of care. You have those in both places. The need that an organization needs to make their budget, they need to make money per se, even though you're a nonprofit. You need enrollment equals money equals budget equals survival. That's obviously the same with whatever organization you might be sitting on. You have to monitor legal compliance. We'll talk a little bit about how that's best done. And then both nonprofits in both roles would be under IRS scrutiny. Now, five key differences, however, would be that your nonprofit's existence, more or less, is tethered to charters, which have a term, which are overseen by different organizations. So that's a very unusual construct for a nonprofit to have a license. I will call it a contract or a license to operate that is, you know, tethered to another organization. And that charter, that's the second thing would be different here. That charter dictates certain things. It dictates accountability and the things you have to do and the promise you made. Really, your charter is your constitution in a way. It's the contract with the granting agency. You promise to do those things and to strive to achieve those results. And that's where the focus needs to be in achieving accountability. It also outlines certain things you can't do. It says, you know, we won't do this or we won't do that. And as I said before, although you're subject to IRS oversight, in California, a nonprofit is subject to Attorney General oversight. Here, you're also subject to your granting agency oversight, the County Office of Education oversight, California Department of Ed oversight, and the State Board of Education oversight as well. So you've got multiple layers of public agency oversight.
I might add that Ted Coldery, who is really the father of charter schools out of Minnesota and a good friend of ours and of the school, always referred to us as contracted schools from the beginning. And when we wrote the book Charter Storm, throughout the book, we refer to charters as contracted schools. And if in some way we could ever bring back that language, that would be wonderful. I can't make myself always say it, but that concept of a contracted school means there's a deal that is drawn between both entities. And in my mind, that would solidify what the expectations are, rather than being in a situation where one of those entities keeps changing their mind, right, or moving from a perception kind of a interpretation, rather than sticking to what the agreement was.
Is building on that right now, Mary, in the law. And again, this is building on what I said earlier about the public-private nature of charter schools, is that we've seen a litany of new cases come along, starting in Arizona and in California as well, and now one that's being sought after before the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that charter schools are contractors for the provision of public education, and thus the employees of the charter school are not state actors for purposes of constitutional limitations, and nor would their employees, students, be protected by constitutional rights. Now, this has major ramifications. So right now, there is a case in Arizona that doesn't necessarily apply to, depending on which court you're in California, that said, sadly, charter schools are like prison contractors, because that is a public good being delivered by a private entity. And therefore, when the prison officers get into a fight or engage in excessive force, they're not subject to the constitutional limitations and through the Civil Rights Act that apply through what's called Section 1983, and therefore they're not liable for those damages. California has expanded that to say in some employment cases and some district court decisions that the officers can't violate the First Amendment rights of employees or the due process rights of students being expelled. I think it's North Carolina decision is being sought to the U.S. Supreme Court, saying we are more private, we are private organizations, and therefore we can enforce dress codes that would or maybe even violate equal protection laws under the Constitution. So it's a very dynamic and I personally think kind of strange construct right now, that the law may be pushing us more towards a private contractor relationship than a public agency. So it's something to be aware of and to watch out for. I know that people in California are worried about where that might go, because that would mean that you could have religious charter schools. If taken to its extreme, you could have just religious charter schools where you obviously cannot have religious public, you know, a K-12 institution can't be religious.
So that's an extreme. But it would also take us back to the day where we had more flexibility in terms of our curriculum and instruction. And we were not bound by, you know, a test that may or may not be relevant to our students. So we could really strive for the kind of instruction that we want to do without having to worry about teaching to the test. That would be just one. There would be no limit to how much we taught, we pay our teachers. And although technically there's no limit right now, you got to watch it with the union, you know, and to stay kind of in the range and not be too far beyond. But if it was truly looked at as a contracted school, the teachers would be happier because they would be able to teach the way they were meant to teach. And certainly administrators would not be hampered by a lot of them, again, perceived red tape, which is unnecessary. So it's an interesting thing for these charter leaders that are on today to watch as we go forward. There's always extremes. Things right. can always be misused, but it also holds some tremendous possibilities.
It does. And we would, you know, eliminate some of the things that we've heard, you know, like school districts claiming a gift of public funds and misappropriation of public funds. Those things would go away because those are only applicable to true school district operators. So I'll just say the last couple of things that where a nonprofit board member of a charter school differs from a traditional nonprofit is as we've been saying, you're almost 100%. You are almost 100% funded by public monies coming in from state and federal government. And lastly, most nonprofits kind of get a benefit of goodwill. Charter schools still are controversial 30 years later. You know, you see the controversy daily, unfortunately, in the press. So those would be the main takeaways, I think I would say. All right, well, I'm going to talk about these bullets here, and then there's a couple other places where I'll kind of get into them a little more deeply. But role of the board member, and these are the takeaways of like how to be a great board member, the best practices sort of thing. Understanding the difference between management and governance. And again, I know many of you are either in management or on a board of another place and probably have a pretty clear division. But a lot of our clients, you know, much smaller, less well-heeled organizations and sophisticated organizations like yourself struggle with this because the board moves beyond governance, and which is obviously the goals and the oversight and the evaluation and setting the broad compass settings of where the organization will go into the day-to-day management. They get into the administrative aspect of those boards that, you know, that top, again, especially if they're parent elected boards or whatnot, and they think they need to be the ones making the decision of who to hire, who to fire, you know, how to paint the classrooms. They get into that level of management. And so the board's role is to govern. The board's role is to set, you know, to work with the staff and set the goals and the high level budgets and to do some strategic planning and work on the overall direction the organization wants to go, which is in large part dictated by your charters, as we've already said. And therefore the rest of it, the day-to-day operation is done by the administration. And you have a good structure because your board is, a lot of these clients' boards are meeting twice, three times a month. And so there's just, I think there's almost an implication there that they should be making more of the day-to-day decisions because they meet more frequently. Instead here, you've got a more successful structure where your administration does the work, updates the board, and your board doesn't have to meet as frequently. How do you know whether you're in management versus governance? Well, it's a how well versus how well. So how well is the board's question of governance? How well are we doing? How well are we meeting those things that Paul was talking about academic accountability, fiscal solvency, legal compliance? How will something get done is the administration's function. And then they, through your single point of contact, your CEO, are held accountable through an evaluation process. So as part of that, you would imagine avoid administrivia, which is, you know, anytime you're getting into those fine, which you don't see on your agendas because this, again, your organization is really well run. But if you saw a lot of those finer detailed decisions about, class schedules and bell schedules and things that were being made, or like I said, what color to paint the exterior of a building, then you know you were getting down into that administrative minutia. Board members also should understand that as individual board members, you have almost no authority unless the board as a whole appoints you to have some authority. The board operates as an organization only through a lawfully confined meeting where there's a quorum and a majority decision. Individual board members, again, unless through either the express provisions of the bylaws or through a vote of the board, electing a board member to have some authority, individual board members have no authority. They have no authority to resolve questions or concerns. They should be redirecting questions and concerns to the staff. The best boards are ones that respect the majority of the board. If you're in a minority decision and it wasn't the decision of the board that you wanted, it's still the healthy board say, I didn't vote for it, but it's the majority decision, I support it because I believe in the process. I believe it will work in the long run. And so I know your boards are more unified. They're you know, more developed professionally and they function at a high level, but we see a lot of the schools fail because of division on the board and open public acrimony and fighting.
Again, for those that are participating for the first time, we operate, have always since day one, operated under a model of consensus. And the administration who actually prepares the materials to be presented to the board will never present to the board something which would create, you know, divisiveness. And so we work through a process where consensus is arrived at before a formal presentation is ever made to the board. So that's, I think, a real secret to the success. And as you said, the people that join our board are extremely high level, all with different types of expertise, whether it's finance, law, PR, you know, parent perspective, community at large, whatever. They are extremely high functioning. And so that helps us always work for consensus. I can't think ever where we had, I think once we had a recusal like 25 years ago, because it was a conflict of interest. This person knew somebody, whatever. But other than that, we've always had an affirmative vote.
Thank you, Mary. You brought me on my next point. You know, the conflicts of interest. So the board, you know, high functioning boards that do well are aware of, understand, and monitor for conflicts of interest. And well, we've got a whole section of slides which we'll talk about that. Yeah. And the board has to effectuate their fiduciary duties, duty of care, duty of loyalty. I've got a slide coming up where I talk about those. And they maintain that commitment through both being prepared for meetings and exercising a duty of loyalty to the organization. And then, as I was saying in the beginning, the five primary points of board oversight occur on around number one, academic accountability, number two, fiscal oversight, number three, legal compliance, and really four is safety, environment, facilities. Those kind of all fall into the same category about making sure that you're asking the right questions of your staff to make sure that the students, teachers and staff, et cetera, are safe. And then the board is responsible for a certain level of complaint processing if a complaint is unable to be resolved by the administration and or, for example, if there were ever a complaint that involved higher level senior administrators, typically the board chair and the board would be involved in complaint processing. But beyond that, all complaints, if there are any, and there typically will, because it's almost impossible in the academic world to please everybody, should be rerouted through, if they come to you as a board member, should be rerouted to administration for processing. All right, the fiduciary duties, if you've been on a board as a nonprofit or if you're a high-level administrator or organization, you understand you have two primary fiduciary duties. Duty of care is the one in the law that always cracks me up. It's the sort of duty to act in a reasonable and informed manner. What does a reasonable manner mean? Well, it's the reasonable person standard, you know, yeah, that you take in, absorb, ask for, and garner as much information as you need that a reasonable person would be able to understand what's before them and make a decision. So you have the right as a board member to ask for a second opinion, an expert opinion, a legal opinion, a fiscal person opinion, whatever, before you make any decision that's being before you. If you do not, and you didn't understand that which you were deciding upon, then technically you're violating your duty of care. Now, if you violate your fiduciary duties, the organization can be responsible, but you personally can be liable. It doesn't happen often, but you know, if board members, if you just had rubber stamp, if you had an organization that was just rubber stamping the administration, never checking, never asking questions, and something went terribly wrong, then someone could go look back and say, well, the board members breached their fiduciary duty. Duty of loyalty is a little different. It means that you're always acting in the best interest of the corporation, and here the corporation slash the schools that you're a part of, and that you're always looking through the lens of what's in the best interest of this organization. It's not, if you had your own personal business, or you had a bias for, I don't know, something that wasn't the best interest of the organization, then you're operating in that direction, pushing in that direction, then technically you're violating your duty of loyalty. Duty of loyalty typically comes up with conflicts. So if a board member is involved in a decision in which they are indirectly or directly financially interested, or interested in other ways, let's just say, for example, you're a board member and you're a parent and you had a child in the school, and the teacher, if it came to you, it wouldn't in this situation because of the way you're structured, but to say the teacher termination was coming, your child's teacher termination was coming to you for final decision, one could say under common law conflict of interest, I need to stay out of this because this is my child's teacher, because I'm connected, even though it's not a financial interest. And so that's maintaining the duty of loyalty, because you can't be 100% impartial in those types of decisions. There's a number of corporate duties that come up every year. There are things that are maintained and monitored by your staff. I've never, again, working with Mary and Lynn for all these years, and Tim, none of these have ever become an issue, because you calendar frequently the reporting that needs to be done to the IRS and the Franchise Tax Board for annual statements of expenditures and revenues, statement of officers, which update the state on who your board members are and who your officers are for the organization, and then the Form 700s, which we'll talk about, which you're all familiar with and have completed, I'm assuming by this point, as part of the conflict of interest provisions.
And Angela is very significant in facilitating a lot of that for us.
I should have mentioned that, because I'm the one who gets the emails from Angela saying it's time to file your Form 700. So I should know that. Yeah, thanks, Mary. Corporate duties and maintaining the corporate structure of the organization, you know, annual meetings, election of officers, making sure your board members are up to date, maintaining corporate records and books is important as well, which is all being done by the administrative staff for you. So let's just turn now to your structure, as Mary said, and this is, you're not unique, but you are a little more unusual than most in that you are now collectively operating under the umbrella of Altus Schools. Altus Schools is not a thing. It's not an entity. It is a more or less trade name, intellectual property, umbrella of two corporations. And I've got a definition on the next page I'll go to. We have two corporations operating, obviously, student success programs, the one I've known the longest, with Charter School of San Diego and Adeo Charter School, and then Adeo Charter School Corporation. It always prends there to make sure it's always clear because of the overlapping names of the schools, with those six schools. And it's my understanding, Mary, as I recall, that the ADA between these two corporations is about more or less equal, on par. So even though one has
six. And this was organic, because the Charter School of San Diego, of course, was the anchor school, which we intended for San Diego boundaries. Adeo Charter School was designed to encompass those schools that were out of San Diego Unified. So for many years, many of these schools here were under Adeo Charter School, that was just our design. And when the Shasta case happened, we got everybody under Adeo Charter School. Let's see, how did that work? But each one has a different authorizer, pretty much.
Yeah.
That wasn't consistent with the original design.
Wasn't it also that San Diego City Schools said they did not want to oversee a nonprofit that held charters that were out of the district?
Did they say that?
I vaguely remember that. And that's not uncommon either. LA was trying to do that for a long time either. So then you would have had, you know, SSP overseeing two charters here, these being outside San Diego for the most part, under a separate nonprofit. And so we've had other clients, Magnolia and others, have done the same thing in order to assuage school districts because they had this strange, there's no legal reason. But the thing to remember here is that while you operate under this one umbrella, and I'll talk a little bit about the intellectual property and facilities and the fiscal division, you are two separate nonprofit public benefit corporations. This board for Adeo Charter School owes its fiduciary responsibilities and duties to this set of organizations. Likewise, this set, and they are distinct. And when we talk about the policies that have been sort of amended and clarified, it's to clarify the budgeting, finances, confidences, board meeting, you know, everything functions on this side of the house and on this side of the house, separate and distinct. But there are agreements, an MOU, as you know, because you proved it, between the two organizations to collaborate at a very high level. And then there are certain administrators that are also shared between the two organizations to maintain the continuity, history, and strength of the overall organization. So as I was saying, each nonprofit operates independently and governs their respective charter schools in accordance with their respective charters, bylaws, et cetera. Now, there are, if you studied all the charters and the bylaws and the policies, there's a lot of similarity, and only Mary and Lynn and Tim and some others would probably be able to note the differences between them, but there's a lot of similarity between them. And then ALTA schools, and this is what I think is really important, is to, you know, everybody be able to say this to people, because you see it on the building, obviously, Hunikins, you drive up and it says ALTA schools, beautiful structure. There's an impression there that that's one entity. And it's one collective group of people operating to, you know, I say all rowing in the same direction, but it is two distinct entities. And so ALTA Schools itself is not a legal entity, but refers to as, and I think this is language Mary and Lynn and everybody came up with, but first to the philosophy, systems, practice, procedures, and culture that comprise the concepts surrounding the creation of schools under each nonprofit that supports an innovative approach to personalized education, the professional development of employees, and data-informed change to create sustainable schools, otherwise the ALTIS model, right? So that's important. We had to, you know, every time we get into an issue of the granting agency trying to explain the difference between Adeo Corp and SSP, Student Success Programs, and ALTIS schools, that's how they all fit together. And more specifically, there's an agreement now between the two nonprofits that's a memorandum of understanding that is something in writing people can refer to, even though this was occurring before, but now it's all codified, that talks about the intellectual property. And the intellectual property here would be the ALTA school's name, the ALTA school's model, the logo, the color scheme, everything like that. That intellectual property, which was that resides with SSP and has been licensed to Adeo without fee. So again, allows the organization to operate under the umbrella. And the facilities that are owned by the Bonita and Hunikins site that are owned by SSP that are shared between the two corporations with Adeo, picking up the fee, the cost of the operation to make sure that there's a pro rata share paid for insurance and maintenance and all the things, utilities and et cetera, that it consumes more or less by being in the shared facility. So it's important that everybody understand that structure, two nonprofits, contract between them, shared facilities, shared intellectual property, and shared employees, with some people having, as you know, two employment agreements. So they receive, well, they receive as many, as I understand, Mary, so you're still receiving as many checks as there are charter schools if you're employed by the two corporations, but you have two employment contracts. So when, and we're going to discuss this a little bit with you all as a Dale board, all this did not directly influence you. It's good for clarification that everybody's aware of this. But when the San Diego City Schools was following up on the, as they do through their oversight and other parts of what they're doing with SSP, they wanted to make sure that we were, that we clarified and asked for further memorialization of our practices through some of these areas. And so you've got, in your bylaws too, the right of a parent representative for the board. There is also, because you have joint employees, each employee that works for a charter school that may have direct interaction with students has to get DOJ clearance. And so if you've got two contracts, that means you're gonna have to get DOJ clearance twice. And they just wanted to make sure that that was clarified.
I just like to differentiate that many of these have, many if not most, I have to look at it, have been in place from the beginning. Like it's always been in our charters from the beginning that a parent representative, was eligible to sit on the board, always. And DOJ clearance has always been something that we've done. And under the direction of the district, we were doing it appropriately, but then they changed their mind about how it needed to be done, I guess, based on a new law that was passed, which means there has to be separate DOJ clearance. So I just want to be sure that everybody understands that we've always had a work travel policy. We've always had employee contracts. We've always had ratification of our real estate transactions. We didn't do it out there in the ether. And so most of these have always been in place, but some, a couple, like personal email addresses, I don't think we ever had a policy that said you couldn't use your personal email address for whatever, but we do now. So
in the Alta school, Mark, we just codified what was already occurring between the two organizations. But the district wanted to see equal benefits between the SSP and Adeo Corp employees, which is the case. The employee board member, they wanted to make sure there were no employee board members. And although a nonprofit public benefit corporation and many charter schools do, and it's perfectly legal to have employee board members, some districts, and San Diego is one of them, do not want employee board members on the board. They believe it has sort of an inherent conflict of interest.
And we had employee board members on Merus for many years because it was hard to get board members anyway. But when we merged, we moved away from that.
Perfectly lawful, but
just to avoid it. But it was perfectly lawful, yes.
Yep. And the districts wanted to make sure that there's a confidentiality between the two corporations. That there's a sharing of information. You're as an employee of a charter school, you're going to come in contact with confidential student record information, personnel record information, healthcare information. And they would just want to make sure that everybody was aware of their duties and responsibilities to maintain that confidential information in the individual two corporate structures. And that any services going on between the two organizations was outlined in a contract between the two. And that some of these other more minor ones, like they wanted to see board meetings in the evening and at least one board meeting in the evening or after 4:30, I think it was. And that any future, any work for outside development of charters, so your articles of incorporation, your bylaws, your charter, the law allows an organization to do work beyond just the schools. In fact, your specific purpose talks about supporting of public education, not just the Alta schools. So if you were to want to assist another charter school in another state or whatnot, they just wanted to see the process for how such an agreement would come into place. And like Mary said, work travel policies, those just get updated regularly anyway, because they want to make sure that the list of things you shouldn't be spending money on that's not going to be reimbursed is up to date. Mary, it looked like you had a comment.
I didn't.
Okay. Personal email addresses, though, maybe the update there too is in part because the California Supreme Court a couple of years back decided that as a public entity, if you do business on a private device or private email, it can be subject to a Public Records Act request. So just be aware, and this is what the policy says, is if you're doing school business, do it through the school's domain only. Don't use a Yahoo or Gmail account to the highest extent possible, because if there's ever a Public Records Act request, an outside requester can ask for all of your personal emails to the extent they involve school business. And you just don't want to have to be in that position of trying to prove up that you went through your own emails and looked at it. And I actually, this wasn't even asked for, but the SSP, and I think, I can't remember, do they share the compliance officer, Mary, or is the compliance officer just at SSP?
Shared,
okay. Great idea. Again, it's unfortunate as year over year over year, and we've shifted away from the main focus being academic accountability, now legal compliance being number two unfortunate, but it's just growing. So having a compliance officer is very common in charter schools now that are they're large enough. They're large enough to afford to be able to do that. So
I have a quick question. Are we allowed to have Adeo schools emails? Because sometimes in businesses where you're not an employee, you can't actually have Adeo's, you know, your company, that company's email. Because I'm using my personal email address for all these communications.
Yeah, if you can, I think each board member is assigned, are they not, Mary? Is it either an Alta Schools or Adeo? I'm not quite sure where you are in the transition for a domain that would be public. So you, if, but again, that's assuming that you're wherever you're receiving your emails during the day, board member, you're able to, you know, get access to somebody. I suppose you could go online.
The majority of our board members from the beginning preferred not using their own personal emails. And so Angela is in charge of assigning every board member their Altus email. So they have an email, and if you'd like one, Waylon, we can set that up right away.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. I can reach out to Angela. It's no problem.
Okay. And it's like wmyers@altusschools.com. The only thing is the board members have to check those emails. Sometimes they get them and then they forget about them.
I will make sure I forward it. Don't worry.
Okay.
There you go. I would only say the only thing that's ever come about, well, two things have come about. Like I said, the California Supreme Court said that if a Public Records Act is made and they ask for you to check your text messages and your personal record, personal emails, you have to do that and attest on, you know, with the threat of perjury. We did have a very unusual case where we had a board member who was a employee of a college, a public college. And somebody made a Public Records Act request of the college to get access to the emails that were coming in related to the school. And so we got involved in a litigation over whether they could get access to that. But so if you're in private business, that's probably not going to be an issue. These were some of the policies that SSP amended. And I understand there's some parallelism between these policy amendments and Adeo as well. I think the main one that, again, is was practiced beforehand, but that is codified now in a policy is number 6 here, the salary apportionment policy. And that was just codification of the fact that, again, salaries of employees that work across multiple organizations are going to be apportioned between the two organizations and apportioned between the individual schools based upon multiple factors, enrollment, special education student count, you know, different factors that might, you know, number of charters, the number of schools they work with, et cetera, and that the state administrative staff, senior staff, is going to make that determination for purposes of annual budgeting and apportionment of costs. All right, I want to make sure that I'm going to go through these. We've kind of covered these. I want to make sure we get Brown Act and conflict in here in the next hour with Kayla jumping in. But, you know, 7 Habits of Highly Effective Board Members, borrowing from Stephen Covey years ago, for those of you who've read this. You know, number one, you know, defining the proper roles of the board versus administration. This gets to that issue about the role of governance and the role of management. And the board's primary point of contact is the CEO. That usually is the board chair and the CEO and the board as a whole giving direction to the CEO. And that's the most effective chain of command. And is, you know, most of you probably heard the other analogy between governing and managing is, you know, the owner of the team is the one who is governing, right? Then we want to win the whatever sports metaphor we can use that won't offend Super Bowl, got college football players here. But they don't call the plays, they don't recruit the students. The coach on the field is managing. They're the ones who recruit the students, determine who plays, what plays are called, etc. So that's kind of the broader distinction between managing and governing. Working with established norms for the board. Again, you guys are doing an exceptionally good job with this. You know, you have the board approves the things they need to approve. You work efficiently through the agenda. As Mary said, I don't see board division, but if you did, they should talk about why you're having board division and how you can remedy that. And you know, what is a board member's basis for voting? As we said, fiduciary duties, duty of care, duty of loyalty, informed decision-making.
And board members, am I on? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
And board members, I know it's a joke about when you get these giant reports. And the reason you get those giant reports, of course, is for the issue of transparency. So that in effect, you know, we can certainly say we've given you all the materials, and any questions you have, we're happy to answer and respond to. And we try to simplify it for the board meeting and make it a little more succinct. And we're always open for questions, you know, for calling or even at the board meeting if necessary. But in the interest of time, we try to inform the board members as much as possible so that no one could ever suggest that we are not, that there is not full disclosure with our board. So we overwhelm you with information, not to discourage you, but because we feel that's a safe thing to do.
Yeah, so, you do an amazing job. Yeah,
thank you.
Mary, I'm glad you added the part about summarizing, because just throwing 1,200 pages is a really great way to obfuscate and confuse and hide. So, but you do summarize the material well, which is very much appreciated. We have it if we need to refer or dig deeper, but you do a great job of summarizing, and I really very much appreciate the reporting out at the board meetings, the highlights of those items. So otherwise you would have successfully confused us, but you don't do that. So thank you.
No, and we've through the years kind of co-created with the board structures for making the information more concise. For example, with our financial reports, you'll see that there's basic assumptions there as part of the report. So you know right off the bat, it's like an executive summary sort of, that tells you what that financial document is based on. We also try to do that with other reports, whether it's academic or operational, whatever it is. We try to create, you know, summary pages that bring it all together.
Well, while we're on this topic, I just want to build on that just for a minute. And in the summaries, the part that I think is so important for me and the other board members, I presume, is that you are measuring, when you report out, you're reporting against your targets and your goals, and you were reporting out against your peers, and you're reporting out of what's normal and customary. And you may recall that I asked from time to time, you know, how will we know when, is this normal, or you feel like this is in compliance? How will we, you know, at one point you get nervous, and these questions are usually directed at Mr. Lippel, but I appreciate it. So the way you do that is much appreciated.
Thank you. We try.
So your number four tip here is that you only recognize and sanction group authority. Again, this is not an issue for your organization, but trick question, when is appropriate for the single board member to act on behalf of the board? It almost always is not. Unless they've been given that authority through the bylaws or by board direction. The board operates, as we said, as a whole, speaks with one voice through the administration. You guys use time and efficiency absolutely, you know, amazingly. But you've been to board meetings, I'm sure. Any of you been to a city council meeting, a school district board meeting, and it's 6 hours long and should have been 15 minutes. You know, it's amazing how inefficient many of these public agency board meetings are, but you guys get in, get out, you get straight to the stuff. Like you said, you're well prepared for the board meeting. So not much here. You know, if you weren't getting your materials in advance, you weren't getting the summaries, you weren't able to ask the questions in advance to be able to get clarification, then those are things to be able to work on. Continue to develop the board professionally. Not only, as you, like Mary said, you start with high level, high functioning, well-educated, rounded board members, but doing these types of trainings is terrific, just to keep you apprised of what's going on, and the main things that school districts are picking on, and these things that we're talking about are main things that school districts pick on as part of the renewal and part of the revocations. And when we talk about conflicts in Brown Act, you think those issues would not become a problem, but they are perpetually a problem for many of our clients. So keep up with that. And that leads to the last slide, which is complying with the transparency laws. And making sure that there's three primary transparency laws. You got the Brown Act, which is the state's open meeting law we're going to talk about next, or KLIS. Then we've got conflict of interest laws, which is transparency around decision-making and financial interests. And then lastly, you've got the Public Records Act for public disclosure of public records. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Kayla. Kayla, are you able to screen share? Or I can just, if you want to bring up
the slide. No, I think maybe you'll be the clicker. So when I gave it to you, I lost the ability.
All right, no, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure I was
All right.
Jump on in there.
All right. Hi, everyone. As Paul mentioned, I'm Kayla Haydu, senior counsel in our firm's Walnut Creek office up in the Bay Area. And for the next several slides, I'm going to be talking about everyone's favorite topic, the Brown Act. And we're going to cover six big questions today about the Brown Act. There's three up here today. First is just the purpose of the act, because of course, understanding why this act exists and why it was implemented helps contextualize everything, helps us better understand all of the various provisions and the act's many, many nuances. The second, what constitutes a meeting? This one, of course, is important too, is understanding what actually qualifies as a meeting enables you to understand when you have to follow the act's legal requirements. The third one is, what are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? Fourth, what are the public's rights at meetings? And spoiler alert, they have a lot of rights. Fifth, what are permissible closed sessions? When can you exclude the public and talk about things confidentially and privately? And finally, what are the penalties for violating the act? And if it is violated, what are the remedies? How do you fix it? Sometimes boards do make inadvertent errors. So we go over this section with you just so you know what to expect in advance of any compliance issues. So let's dig in by answering question one. What is the purpose of the act? And as you'll see here, it's the general purpose is to foster broad public access. So the Brown Act is one of those laws that is in the spirit of sunshine and public transparency. And I always think it's helpful to think about this as the fundamental purpose here and what we do in each meeting, because the bottom line is with the Brown Act is that it's to allow the public to have access to your meeting and some limited input into the decisions that you make. It basically provides a mechanism by which members of the public know what you're planning to discuss at the meetings and can participate in, like I said, limited ways about the conversations that you have. But at the same time, we'll just go to the next slide. This public access is not absolute. So something to think about in terms of structuring meetings and agenda, and I know you all know this and do this already, is just where those nuances lie to determine where you can act confidentially, despite this generalized scheme and generalized presumption around public transparency. So there are of course these closed sessions, and they allow for confidential meetings of the board that are not subject to public access. This is just a snapshot list. We'll delve into these a little bit later about what exactly is required in the context of closed sessions to be compliant, but these are the sort of things to think about specifically under the law where public access is not required. Personnel matters, labor negotiations, real property negotiations, receiving advice from the school's attorney, public security, pupil discipline. And like I said, we'll delve into these a little further so you can actually see what those various things mean. But outside of these general areas, you can assume that public access is required and that the conversation is not subject to closed session. Question number two, what constitutes a board meeting? And a meeting occurs, I think it's good just to have a very succinct definition, when any congregation of a majority of the members of the body meet to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of school business. There are, of course, some exceptions to that. So we'll go to the next slide. Certainly, a majority of you can attend a conference of public interest. That might be the Charter School Development Center Conference, could be the A+ conference, which I know happens in San Diego. Both of those are just examples. A majority of you could also attend another public body's meeting, and we see that really often. If one of your charters is up for renewal, for example, a majority of the board might show up at the school district board meeting or at the county board of education meeting to see their discussion of your charter renewal. And you can go, the majority of you can go, all of you can go, and you can also make public comment at that meeting. You can do that. You can, the guiding principle there that is that that's another public meeting. So if you make a public comment, other members of the public can hear what you are saying. So you're still upheld to that transparency threshold. You can also gather together for ceremonial reasons. Think about, you know, high school or whatever, graduation, promotion, award ceremonies. The major caveat, as it's in caps here, is that with all of these, school business cannot be discussed. So you can talk about your kids, you can talk about your job, you can talk about the weather, you cannot talk about school business. If you do, you run the risk of it being a meeting. What about committees? The Brown Act does generally apply to subsidiary committees of the board with very few exceptions. And by the way, it does not matter what you call it. You can call it a task force, you can call it a commission, you can call it whatever you want, but these commissions, committees, and boards are other bodies of a local agency. It doesn't matter if they're permanent or if they're temporary, if they're only operating for a month, doesn't matter, it still could be a committee. Even if they're just advisory or if they're decision-making, if they're created by ordinance, resolution, or formal action of the board, they're subject to the act. And so, you know, our advice there is if you need to create a committee for whatever reason, perhaps you need to include others other than board members to have the requisite buy-in that you need. We see that sometimes. By all means, do so. Do what you need to do for your schools. Just know that the committee is likely going to need to post an agenda and follow the Brown Act. All right, next up, let's talk about. There are some situations where a committee can avoid the Brown Act. So while I will say it generally does apply, if you have an advisory committee that is composed solely of members of the board that are less than a quorum, so less than a majority, it can be not subject to the act unless it is a standing committee which has continuing subject matter jurisdiction, so it's not just temporary, or it has a meeting schedule fixed by ordinance, resolution, or formal action of the body. So all of those things would need to be in place for you to determine that a committee would not be subject to the act. And generally speaking, it will be. Serial meetings, let's talk about those. Those are prohibited under the Brown Act because essentially they're doing the exact opposite of what you're supposed to be doing as a legislative body. So the elements of a serial meeting are listed here. It's anytime you have a majority of board members outside a meeting using a series of communications of any kind, either directly or through intermediaries, and there's some discussion or deliberation or action on school business, then you could face trouble. Where we see this becoming an issue the most is with technology. So, you know, that can result in meetings that you might not expect. Think about like emails, texts, social media, web postings. Be careful there. You know, if your council sends the board a one-way communication or the CEO sends the board a one-way communication, that's an area where we've seen boards get into trouble if there's discussion and discourse back and forth there. And also just on intermediaries, just really fast, you know, an intermediary on the last slide is just someone that you've specifically tasked with conveying a message for you. So if I were on a board and I went to my husband and I gave him a message and said, go tell all the other board members that this is how I feel about this one school issue, that would of course be the same as if I just picked up the phone and told all the board members. So you can't get around it with intermediaries. Additional limits on board communications. This is an interesting point. So while an employer official can engage in separate conversations or communications outside of a meeting with other members of the body in order to answer questions or ask questions or provide information regarding school business, that person just needs to be careful not to communicate to members of the board the comments or position of any other member of the board. This most frequently comes up when a board member might ask staff questions, and staff absolutely has a right to answer any questions that you pose. The only thing that staff would not be able to share with you in that context is they can't share the comments or position of other members of the board. So they wouldn't be able to say, for example, okay, I just got off the phone with Paul and I know that Paul agrees with you about that point or that concern, because then that's just essentially using the staff as an intermediary. But by all means, you know, as Paul was talking about, you're expected to uphold the duty of care. And ultimately what that means is that you can and should ask questions about items if you have them. All right, now we're gonna get into the world of teleconferences. And this—
I'm sorry, but I don't know who, when we put these slides together, I don't know who used this picture, but I'm almost certain that the Brady Bunch was pre the Zoom. I mean, really, most people wouldn't even recognize the pictures of those people. So
that's hilarious.
We really should update that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we should.
I think you should leave that. I love that.
I think half the people on this call don't even know what we're talking about right now.
I'm humming the theme song in my head right now because
like, what are you talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Teleconferences is an area that has received the most changes and the most headache. Actually, there was just a bill. We're going to talk about it today. It was just signed by the governor. So it has, on the whole teleconferencing, it has been a very confusing area under the Brown Act. And like I just said, we're going to change the rules again. But normal teleconferencing, we're going to start there. This was developed, these are the laws that were developed pre-COVID, pre-virtual, pre-remote era, and though it is more onerous, these requirements to have teleconferencing pre-COVID were more onerous than the current COVID era rules, these laws are still in effect. So if you want to follow all of these requirements for teleconferencing, you can and you may, and you would be in compliance. So regular teleconference meetings have six requirements. First, the agenda must be posted at all teleconference locations. So that means if you're teleconferencing in from a hotel, say you're off in Fiji, that's just shows that place because that's a wonderful place. You have to post the agenda there at your hotel. And also vitally, each teleconference location has to be posted. So you of course have to post the address of your hotel, but also the room number where you'll be doing the teleconferencing. The idea there being that members of the public can participate in the meeting from that location if they so desire. Next slide. All votes in the teleconferencing world also have to be taken by roll call. And each teleconference location must be accessible to the public. ADA compliance is required. And so if you're teleconferencing from, say, the second story of your house under these rules, and for example, like many of us, you have stairs and not an elevator, that can be problematic because we wouldn't necessarily have that the requisite ADA compliance. The members of the public under these laws also must be able to hear and must be able to have the right address, have the right to address the board directly from each teleconference location. And finally, a quorum of the board must participate from the charter school's jurisdiction under these rules, which is typically defined as the county or, in your cases, counties in which your schools are located. All right, next up. Okay, so those are the six normal teleconferencing meeting rules. They've been in the Brown Act for years and years and years. Then, of course, March 2020 happened, everything changed. And during the pandemic, Governor Newsom used his authority under the Emergency Services Act to waive most of those requirements through an executive order. Now, that executive order did expire. It expired last year. But what the legislator did is they used AB 361 to replace it. And what AB 361 says is that essentially the charter school board may continue to hold teleconference meetings without adhering to those six more onerous requirements that we just talked about, if certain conditions are met and renewed every 30 days. So here are the flexibilities, I have them up on the slide here, that are afforded under AB 361. One, the agenda does not need to provide notice of each teleconference location. So you don't need to put the home address of all of the board members, nor do the agendas need to be posted at each location. So you also don't need to post that to your front door. A quorum of the board's members also do not need to be located within the charter schools or school's jurisdiction. and the governing board members may participate in a teleconference meeting from places that are not publicly accessible. So you don't have to worry about those ADA compliance rules like you do under the traditional laws. Now, all of that is only true. Those flexibilities are only true if you adopt the appropriate findings. So here's what the conditions have to be and what you have to do. First, we have to be in a proclaimed state of emergency. And there does in California remain a state of emergency due to the pandemic. So even though the governor has scaled back a lot of his executive orders, the declaration of emergency does still remain. So you have to have that. And then you have to also have to have one or two things. First, the state or local officials maybe have imposed or recommended measures to promote social distancing. In the absence of that, the charter school board can determine for themselves that meeting in person would be harmful, would present imminent risks to the health and safety of attendees. So you have to have the proclaimed state of emergency, and then you have to have one of two of those things.
Our chair reads that at every board meeting. That's not the new stuff the governor brought on today, is it?
No, the new stuff, was there something today? There was new stuff just a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to talk about that too. So okay. We're actually going to have this interesting intersection of three different teleconferencing laws happening at the same time. But when we delve into that, you can see, you know, which would be better and more applicable for your board. So if you're meeting pursuant to this AB 361, there are still things that you have to do. And most of these are not, they're self-explanatory, they're not rocket science, but there are two in here that I do want to draw your attention to, because we have seen a lot of schools, not probably not yours, struggle with these. The first is in bullet point number 3. You have to allow members of the public to access the meeting. So if you have a Zoom link, you put the Zoom link, but then this is what trips people up. You also have to describe the manner in which the public can offer public comment. So if you want somebody to use the raise hand feature of Zoom to offer their comment, or you want them to write in the chat, you have to tell them how they can do that. And we recommend that your agenda provide notice actually about how you want people to behave in public comments so that they do know what to expect. Just a quick note too on this last one here, it's timely because we in the state had rolling blackouts just last month, a little bit over a month ago. So if there is a technical disruption and the broadcast goes out, you have an issue. You need to be careful there. You cannot take any further action until public access is restored. The others, like I said, pretty self-explanatory. You have to continue to protect statutory and constitutional rights. You have to give notice and post agendas. I know you all are very on top of that. You do not require members of the public to submit comments in advance of the meeting. They have to be able to participate in real time. And then you can also provide a timed or reasonable period for public comments. So that's just to ensure that you don't just quickly ask for public comment and seeing nothing right away, move on.
Hey, Kayla, pardon me. Based on what you just said about providing notice and information on how the public can or may comment, you know, electronically, does our agenda provide for that? Do you think we're doing that now?
Do you all in your agendas, I should have looked at your, at this most recent one, in your agendas, do you have the specific mechanism by which they you want them to comment? It's something that we recommend. It's not necessarily required in the law. You do have to describe the manner. So in the meeting, if you do say, you know, if you have public comment, please raise your hand, or please use the raise hand feature, or please say in the chat. I've heard that in several board meetings, but we're advising that you actually go a step further and say in the meeting, if you want to make a public comment, you can raise your hand, or you can, you know, do however you all want.
Public comment is always on the agenda. Well, there's public comment for things on the agenda and public comment for things not on the agenda. And the chair always calls for comment. And as part of what he shares is what the parameters are, like you may speak for 2 minutes and it can only be extended by the chair, and you may only speak on this item like that.
But we just don't mention how to do it, because in Zoom, in Zoom, it's more like use the chat room or press the raise your hand button. That might be a nice, if we want to follow this, that'd be a good addition.
Yeah.
Is that the expectation to outline that technical?
I would. I mean, that's what we've been recommending lately, because it just ensures that the public is exceedingly and exceptionally clear about what you want them to do.
And do you have that already written up and prepared?
We can write that up for you. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But you know, at this rate, all those comments you're supposed to read are longer sometimes than what we have for the meeting. It's a long, long list of things that we read all the time.
Absolutely. I think
I know that's not your thing, but it's
right. But I think that could literally be as simple as if you want to make a public comment, please use the raise hand feature in Zoom, period. You know, you don't need to go into it. In addition to that, you have 2 minutes and it can only be extended language. So I know it is another sentence, but not like another paragraph.
Mm, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Okay, and then assuming you're going to use this AB 361 flexibility, the board does have to, and we'll just turn to the next slide, the board does have to take action every 30 days to renew your finding. And again, you have to have reconsidered the circumstances of the state of emergency, ensure that we're still in that state of emergency. And then one of the following two things, you know, the local, or there must, you know, maybe there's a local ordinance about a meeting in person, or you as the board can determine that it would be safer to do so remotely.
And Kayla, the way we do that is before we do any action item, the board votes for the findings, the chairman of the board reads that finding. Then once that is approved by the board, then we go into the action.
Yeah. I watched it today. I thought it was, I think it's really, you're doing an excellent job there.
Mm-hmm. When the state of emergency goes bye-bye, which it will eventually.
It will.
Do we have any basis for continuing our meetings on a teleconference basis? Because our board members are stretched throughout the whole county, because our schools are, you know, so I mean, they're everywhere. And it's much more practical, and I believe it's the wish of the board to continue in a teleconference mode. Will that be difficult?
Absolutely. Well, this is a great segue actually into our next slide, because the legislator has adopted this new scheme where you can continue teleconferencing.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's good. It's different though. So I'll get into the requirements. And then also you do always have the option of the pre-COVID teleconferencing requirements, but there, you know, of course the majority of the board still has to participate from in the county. But this is the new law. We're changing the teleconferencing rules again. Like Mary said, this is the perfect segue. Eventually the state of emergency is going to end. And even if it doesn't, SB 361 expires in January of 2024. So this law now is just very, very recently, just a couple weeks ago, came into being. It was signed by the governor. First thing to emphasize here is that it is not effective until January 1st, 2023. So everything that we're going to chat about in the next several slides will not be applicable until the start of the new year. And frankly, and I think unfortunately, this is a complicated bill. There are a lot of requirements to exercise this flexibility. So when January 1st comes along and your school is getting ready to post the agenda, we recommend reviewing these slides, which we emailed out just at the start of this meeting. It's complicated, but we're going to walk through it. So the first thing to keep in mind about this flexibility is that it's only available for personal emergencies and for just cause. The statute does expressly and helpfully define what those mean. So I'll go over those in a little bit. But know that either of these circumstances have to be present. When there is a personal emergency or there is just cause, this bill allows the teleconferencing requirements to be relaxed. It also allows teleconferencing without obligation to identifying the location on the agenda. Again, you don't have to post your house agenda or your work agenda or wherever you're doing your meeting from. And it also does not require that the public have access to that location. However, and this is different, the board member must participate through both audio and visual technology under this law. So if you're driving, for example, and you're on the road and you only want to participate through audio, that's not sufficient. We need to see you. Okay, again, this flexibility is only available in the case of just cause or emergency circumstances, and it can only be exercised in a limited degree. For just cause, for example, and again, I'm going to define these, it can only be used 2 times per calendar year. So those boards that meet, you know, 3 times a month, like Paul was talking about, they're going to eat this up really quickly. The other case is where there's an emergency circumstance. There, if one of the board members has an emergency, the governing board must take action to approve that board member's request to participate remotely. And in taking action, the board also has to provide a general description of the item of the emergency requested, but there, of course, there's no need to disclose personal medical information. It can be very general. This person had an emergency. So just to be really clear, just cause you can only do, does not require board approval, but can only be exercised 2 times per year. The second one, this emergency circumstances, does require board approval, but does not have that same 2 times a year limitation, though there is a more global cap, which we'll get to in a sec.
But this is not to say that we cannot continue as we're doing now. We can continue as we're doing now. This is only if we want to take away the thing about posting the agenda and whatever that second one was, allowing the public access to, you know, phoning in or participating.
Exactly. So there's going to be a period of a year starting in January where there's actually 3 different ways that you can teleconference. You can teleconference under this law. You can teleconference if there's still a proclaimed state of emergency. You can under 361, or you can just go back to the old teleconferencing requirements pre-COVID. And but there you have to make sure that a majority of the board is within the jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's fine. And the access to participating by the public, it doesn't have to be in every single person's location, does it? We offer throughout the county or city, county, sites, school sites where they can go to participate. Right. So, you know, if somebody is in their home, that doesn't mean they open their home for people to come and speak, not as long as there is access at some of the other sites.
Right. Okay. And not under these or the 361.
Got it. So okay. Board.
Yeah, a lot of boards have been asking that question. You know, I think it has been exceptionally helpful for boards to be able to do this remotely. And so this is, although this is kind of, there's, it's a little bit more onerous than 361 and it's a little bit more complicated. It does allow for that continue virtual, which I know is really appreciated. Okay, so the definitions, of course, this is exceptionally important. Emergency circumstances means a physical or medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. And I kind of like this definition. It's vague and it doesn't require anything like hospitalization or anything. And so that ambiguity gives board members flexibility. Just cause, on the other hand, does have a clearly articulated definition, but it can be many things. It can be childcare needs. It can be helping parents' needs that would require you to participate remotely, contagious illness, would require you to physical or mental disability that's otherwise not accommodated, travel. Now, this one's interesting. It's like travel while on business of this governing board or another state or local agency. So that's kind of refined. But for me, as somebody who has a preschooler who is like constantly sick, I really appreciated the first 2 flexibilities there because it does allow you that out. Okay, now teleconferencing based on an emergency, again, it's that kind of vague definition. It requires that the member make a request remotely as soon as possible, or to participate remotely as soon as possible. The member also has to seek a separate request for each meeting in which they're trying to participate remotely. So it can't just be, you know, my situation, I'll see you, you know, in a year. If there were, but I liked this too, this added some flexibility too. If the request does not allow sufficient time to place the proposed action on a request to be on the posted agenda, then you as your board can still take action at the beginning of the meeting to grant that request. So we'll go to the next one. Now there's this global cap here. And so in the absence of an extension on SB 361, which is the teleconferencing rules we talked about before, you need to consider these. So under no circumstance, regardless of whether it's just cause or the emergency circumstance situation, under no circumstance can a member act in a remote capacity for three consecutive months, for 20% of the regular meetings within a year, more than this, or more than two meetings if the legislative body meets fewer than 10 times per calendar year. So this global cap is really important to keep in mind. It sounds like for you all, you'll be fine adhering to the pre-COVID teleconferencing rules. And so potentially this won't be as cumbersome for you all, but it is. I was a bit disappointed to see
this. Is onerous, and it's going to cause some real confusion with many of the charter schools. Not us, because we're into a process, you know, using the pre-COVID stuff.
Yeah.
But they're going to think that this is replacing the pre-COVID option. Yeah. That's going to be a real problem.
It is going to be a real problem. It's going to be exceptionally confusing too, because like I said, as of January 1st, 2023, so in just a few months, we're going to have these three different ways that you can teleconference and meet the Brown Act compliance. So it's going to be tough. Other requirements, at least, so there's still other requirements under this SB or AB 2449, at least a quorum of the members must participate in person under this. So it's really supposed to be more of like a one-off emergency situation as opposed to the entire board meeting remotely. Members of the public must also be provided with a means to remotely hear and visually observe the meeting. I know you all already have this set up, the two-way audio visual platform or a two-way telephonic service and live webcasting. That's what you all do. You do that broadcasting of the meeting. So you're good there, but the first bullet point, I think, is the most important, where it can't just be all of the board members have this emergency circumstance that would warrant this remoteness. The agenda must also provide notice of how members of the public can access the meeting and can provide a public comment. You can't require the public comments to be submitted in advance. If the broadcast is disrupted, this was the same as under 361, the board may not take action until remote access to the meeting is restored. The board can also not require public comments to be, I think we had that twice, submitted in advance. And then finally, this one I thought was just a little odd. The member has to publicly disclose before any action is taken if any individual is 18 or over in the room with them. And then not only do they have to disclose that, but they have to also say what the nature of their relationship with that person. It's a little odd. So that's going to be funny. But so those are the different requirements. So I just want to be super clear. We're heading off of the teleconferencing thing. There are going to be three teleconferencing schemes. I know that you all get it, but it is going to definitely be very complicated.
Who votes on these rules? Like, who comes up with this stuff?
This is the legislator. Our public legislator working for us.
But don't they ask anybody about this? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
It was insane. Waylon, you're in California. These are joke questions, right?
No, but I mean, can't we vote for this?
No, you voted for the legislators.
Did I?
You know, I'm not only concerned about our small charters, but I'm concerned about our districts.
Yeah.
Up and down, somewhere along the line, when you're doing your conferences, presentations and stuff, you really need to try to attract the district so they understand that, you know, we are adhering to the rules because we've selected an option that is the regular option.
Right.
And maybe differentiating by name is better. Like there's the regular option, the COVID option, and the post-COVID option. I mean, some kind of simple language.
It has to be something other than just numbers. I agree. It's gonna be a mess. But what are the notice and agenda requirements? So we're leaving teleconferencing. We're going back just into question three. The golden rule is, with limited exceptions, if it's not on the agenda, do not talk about it. This rule bears on the transparency and sunshiny requirements of the act. The technical rule is that the agenda shall be posted properly in advance. I know you all are exceptionally good at this, and must include a brief description of the items to be transacted or discussed. There are limited exceptions when the board can discuss a non-agenda item. Rarely authorized emergency situations, think like public health emergency, safety emergency, is very rarely applied circumstance. You can also discuss continued matters if the agenda item was posted from the prior meeting within 5 days or less, and then the matter was continued. So if you had a meeting, but you had like a board cutoff, I know some boards have cutoff times, and so you had to continue it on to the next meeting, you can continue to discuss it even if it wasn't on this agenda, if it's within these 5 days.
Neither one of these things is recommended to ever do.
Yeah. Right. You can also give direction to staff. You can also give brief responses, clarifying questions, announcements, and a discussion over future agenda items. But again, brief and as Paul said, not recommended. Let's chat for a second about the board interaction with the public. The board can interact with the public on agenda items beyond receiving input, but significant board interaction with the public during comment is not a best practice. You run the risk of getting into a matter that is not agendized and then being not in compliance. So these are the possible risks attendant to that extensive interaction. You could have discussion of topics not on the agenda. It can also just result in inefficiency. And I know you all are very efficient and not chaotic, but that's not true of all schools. And it can also have some issues just internally with the board and board decision if new things are brought up that they weren't anticipating.
Well, and sometimes when you're observing other district board meetings and people do that, it's not that they're being rude and ignoring the public comment. It's that it's very imprudent to do it, especially since before you've talked to the superintendent or, you know, or each other or staff.
Yeah, no, I think it is weird for the public though, sometimes when they're not getting a response back. And so I have seen boards, you know, just explicitly say, you know, we cannot engage in dialogue with you. This is not the forum to do it. Quickly, the agenda posting requirements, you all know these. It's 72 hours for a regular meeting, so 71 hours and 59 minutes is not in compliance. Special meetings, 24 hours. Emergency meetings, again, really, really, really rare, extreme, dire circumstance, safety, something that can't even wait for this 24-hour special meeting period. Where must the agenda be posted? So it has to be physically posted in a publicly accessible location for the entire posting period. So if it's a regular meeting, it has to be up there for the entire 72 hours. And then this is the one that trips some people up, although I do think that people are getting better about it, but we did see it come up fairly regularly at the beginning. It's, you have to, on your homepage, have a prominent direct link that's downloadable to your board agenda. And this can be low-hanging fruit for authorizers if they go to your website and the agenda is not readily accessible, as it has to be under the law. So just a word of caution there. Closed session. As we talked about earlier, there are 6 reasons why the board can meet in closed session for purposes of discussing certain items that are allowed under the Brown Act to be discussed confidentially. The default rule, of course, is that you're always in open session unless the legislator has provided you with that very specific exception to meet in closed session. When you do meet in closed session, a few pro tips for you. One, the legislator has included, this is an area where they were helpful, some safe harbor language in the act. And we call it safe harbor language because the legislator has essentially said, if you use this language and you fill in the blanks, then people can't challenge you on your agenda and claim that that item is insufficient. The board chair must also provide an oral notice in advance of closed session. That's as simple as just the board chair reading from the agenda of the safe harbor language that's on it. And then point three, the board must make a public report once you open back up into open session in any closed session action that was taken, if any. It can definitely be the case that no action is taken, and that's fine. You can just report that no action was taken. Next slide here. A quick note about executive compensation, because we actually saw this come up in the last year. The legislator has determined that a CEO or ED's compensation must occur at a regular and not a special meeting. What it says here in the act is that prior to final action, the board must orally report a summary of the recommendation for final action, including the salary schedule, fringe benefits, during the open meeting where the final action will be taken. And the idea here is that, again, it's that sunshine law. It's to shine a bright light on the compensation to ensure that it's fair and in proportion to the executive's responsibilities. So just a reminder that that absolutely does have to occur in open session and at a regular meeting. What are the public's rights at meetings? The first is just the right to provide testimony. They have the right to comment both on non-agenda items and agenda items, either before or during the board's consideration of an item. And there are other rights too. While they can tape or broadcast the meeting, the board cannot impose any conditions on attendance, so they can't have to, like, for instance, turn in their driver's license or something before they get to attend. The right to non-discriminatory facilities, we see that again come up with ADA compliance, ensuring that there's ADA accessibility. And then they, of course, have the right to copies of the agendas and other public writings like the board packet. They can have a copy of that. Now, public testimony issues. This is something that comes up quite a lot in meetings. And what happens when we have speakers criticize staff? It's a free speech right for members of the public under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution to speak their mind about the performance of employees. So just because a member of the public is saying something that is perhaps critical or unpleasant, they have the right to do so. Now, we will talk in a little bit, threats are a different story, or they can be. But when a member of the public is engaging in critical speech, it's important that we just allow that speech to continue. We do not and cannot cut it off. The second one on confidentiality is a little trickier. For example, if one of your teachers or one of your employees is speaking and is sharing confidential student information that would be protected under FERPA, it certainly would be within the board's authority and advisable actually to remind them of their duties under the law. But if it's just a member of the public that's sharing confidential information, that's harder to shut down. And the law doesn't tell us exactly what we can do in a circumstance like that. But we have seen courts recognize that there are limits to the First Amendment and there are limits to acceptable and allowable behavior, even in a public forum, even under this act. But these are very narrow circumstances where we would ever actually want to shut down public speak. That dovetails into this acting in a disruptive manner. We're going to talk in a little bit, I think actually in this next slide, about a law that addresses the situation more head on. Another new one for us, SB 1100. It was just signed into law in August, and it provides clarity on the circumstances where the board can act with comfort that the law is behind them. It again, like 2449, is not effective until January 1st, 2023, but it adds this brand new section to the Brown Act that we've never seen before, authorizing the presiding board member or a designee, if, for example, that presiding member is not there, to remove or cause to remove, maybe you have a security guard, an individual for disrupting a meeting. And we're going to define disruption of the meeting. Disrupting means essentially a failure to comply with reasonable and lawful regulations, or engaging in a behavior that constitutes use of force or the threat of force. And this definition really just codifies the First Amendment principles we've always been operating under as it relates to the Brown Act. I think the use of force is pretty clear. In terms of failure to comply with what's reasonable, let's say, for example, you're in an in-person context and you have a member of the public who was entitled to speak for 2 minutes and they go beyond that 2 minutes and they continue speaking. And maybe they're yelling or maybe they're not even yelling, but they're still talking and they've been warned and they won't leave and they won't cede their time. That would certainly be a circumstance that the law contemplates the removal of that individual for. Now, it's really nice in the Zoom context, right? Because you can just turn off their microphone and then you're done with it. But that would be the in-person context. Now, before that removal, there are some requirements. If they are, so you have to essentially warn the individual. You have to say that their behavior is disrupting the meeting. And if they don't stop, then, you know, they might have to be removed. And then you want to then promptly remove them if they don't cease their disruptive behavior. There was an exception there, though, that if they are doing true force of threat, that warning requirement does not apply. So if they are, you know, garnishing a weapon, of course, that, you know, that would not apply. You don't have to go through the warning steps. You can have their removal happen immediately. So that's the new law. I went through it really quickly because I want to be conscious of everyone's time and know we only have 7 minutes left here. And we're going to get through it. But it's pretty, that one is actually pretty straightforward and just broadens your authority and allows you to act with greater understanding of what you can and can't do. Back to the closed session thing, personnel. So these are the reasons that you can have closed sessions. Personnel, think about like appointment of employees, their actual employment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal, release. All those would follow under personnel exceptions. Real estate negotiations, labor negotiations. There you might be discussing compensation or benefits that you don't want publicly available yet. Conference with legal counsel. This can be for both anticipated and existing litigation, public security issues, and pupil discipline. And you'll see some common themes here throughout these six. Like with personnel and pupil discipline, we see it being kind of about the right to privacy. And then real estate negotiations, we want to make sure that you all are getting the best deal for the taxpayer, right? And so that's why they allow those sort of negotiations in closed sessions. Now, what happens in closed session? Stays in closed session. There is this confidentiality requirement. You cannot tell your spouse, you cannot tell your best friend, you cannot tell a member of the school staff, you cannot tell anyone who is not part of the closed session what happened in that closed session without authorization from the board in advance. Okay, and wrapping up here, question six. What are the penalties and remedies for violation of the Brown Act? One thing that's really important to know is that if a violation is found, a court can come in and declare the resulting action null and void. There can also be injunctive relief, and distressingly, prevailing plaintiff is also awarded attorney's fees, which is why we work really hard to, when you do get a notice of a Brown Act violation, to cure that violation, so that the charter school does not get sued, because those prevailing plaintiff fees can be exceptionally expensive. There are also, there's the possibility of criminal penalties, though it's not too often that we see a district attorney actually pursue something like that, but it has happened on occasion over the years, predominantly when the school or the board is in the news for other things, for other reasons. There's also the risk of potential charter revocation, because compliance with all laws is an area that the authorizer is responsible for overseeing. And so they can issue a notice to you and demand that you cure those issues down the line. And then there's also the risk of stakeholder trust being harmed. If they think things are being done that are not above board or that you're operating not in a transparent manner, it can, of course, lead to issues down the line. If you do get into a circumstance where someone is going to send you a notice and demand for cure, generally you're going to have, generally they have to do that within 30 days. Otherwise, there's an extension for 90 days. And then you have 30 days if we just tap the, I think we got to click again.
Sorry.
That's okay. You have 30 days to cure. So you have 30 days to respond. And then last point there, yeah. The demanding party can initiate litigation to compel compliance. And like we said, if successful, it can be attorney's fees and court costs. And so we really try to, when we see one of these, when we see the clients get these, cure these, fix them, go back and redo the action if necessary, and so that you can move on. That is the end of your Brown Act training. And it is essentially the end of today. I think next, on the 17th, we're going to pick up with a number of other interesting, exciting topics, starting with the fall and conflict of interest.
Yep.
But thank you all for today.
Mary, anything you want to wrap? Oh, where'd she go? Anything? Okay.
Nope, nothing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Hey guys, great
job. I think I need to close the meeting. Thank you, young man.
And don't miss it now. We're doing right. So good.
Let's follow some of the rules here.
Brown Act, what was that about? Yeah.
You know me, ever the rule follower. So anyway, thank you, Kayla and Paul. I really appreciate your helping us through this today. So moving along, as we just said, this was part one. Part two of the board workshop training will be held October 17th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. So with that, I would entertain a motion for adjournment.
Laura Barrero, I make a motion that we adjourn.
It's your turn, Christina.
Christina Stevens, I second that motion.
Yes. Thank you. And may I have your vote, please, Laura Barrero?
Barrero, aye.
Waylon Myers.
Waylon Myers, aye.
And Christina Stevens.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Greg Haggard, that's an aye. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.